Has Russia's war in Ukraine stalled? Russian missiles and artillery continue to bombard several cities, but none have been captured after almost a month of fighting. So what is the Kremlin's military strategy, and can its objectives be achieved? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Fully Batibo. The war in Ukraine, which Russia hoped would be over within days, is now into its fourth week. Russian tanks and military convoys remain at a standstill outside the capital, Kyiv. The Kremlin has yet to capture any of Ukraine's biggest cities, despite attacks by land, sea and air. They've targeted mainly residential areas throughout the week, as well as an outpouring of popular support for Ukrainians. Advanced weapons and aid from NATO countries and others are helping stall Russia's advance. Despite the battleground setbacks, Russian President Vladimir Putin has shown little sign of relenting. Rob McBride reports from Lviv.
If Vladimir Putin of Russia had early hopes of his Russian forces achieving magnificent victories over the Ukrainian army, of them being welcomed into Ukrainian towns and cities by populations glad to see Russian forces here, then those hopes are quickly disappearing just as the snows and frosts are giving way to a spring here in Eastern Europe, and time is not on the side of the Russians. Many of the forces that came down from the north have been largely bogged down on long columns in roads in the north of the country. From the south, we have more success being found by better equipped units coming up from the Crimea that maybe are better trained and better motivated, that have seen victories against Ukrainian forces falling back. But the Russians have found that in the towns and cities they have taken over, they are still facing a strong resistance from people who simply do not want them there, and time is not on the side of the Russians. As Putin becomes more of a pariah in the eyes of the world, President Zelensky of the Ukraine, his stature seems to grow by the day. And the longer that the Russian forces are bogged down, the more vulnerable they are to the growing resistance and strength of the Ukrainian military, fed by recruits from home, by volunteers from abroad, and of course all now using increasing amounts of this sophisticated military hardware from the West, the anti-tank missiles, the anti-aircraft missiles, all of them increasingly targeted now at Russian forces. Rob McBride for Inside Story.
Well, let's now bring in our guests for today's Inside Story. In Kyiv, we have Oleksiy Haran, who's a professor of politics at Kyiv Mohyla Academy. He's also the head of research at the Democratic Initiatives Foundation think tank. In London, Anna Matveeva, an expert on Russia and Eurasian affairs. She's also the author of Through Times of Trouble, Conflict in Southeastern Ukraine Explained from Within. And in Washington, D.C., we're joined by Doug Crane. He's an assistant director at the Eurasia Center of the Atlantic Council. That's a U.S. think tank. Welcome to you all. Thank you for being with us on Inside Story. Oleksiy, in Kyiv, let me start with you. If you could tell us about the situation on the ground as this conflict enters its fourth week. Are we seeing a change in Russia's strategy since the initial invasion?
Well, first of all, I would like to... basically, your correspondent in Lviv described the situation quite correctly. So Russian forces stalled, they are exhausted, they are demoralized. And in this situation, what Russia is doing, they are starting to kill civilians, to shell civilian objects, and there's many evidence of that, a lot of videos, a lot of photos. They do not spare maternity houses, children hospitals, and other places. They are blocking evacuation corridors, they are preventing humanitarian convoys to the besieged cities like Kharkiv or Mariupol. And actually, Russians were saying that they are going to liberate Russian speakers. They turned Russian-speaking cities like Kharkiv and Mariupol into Aleppo. They are totally destroyed, bombed and destroyed. So this is the tactics now of Russia, to intimidate to intimidate civilians, to intimidate the West, to intimidate Ukraine, and to intimidate the world community with the threat of nuclear war.
Russia
oh, by the
has,
way,
yes.
I would like to add, excuse me, I would like to add that actually while I am talking to you, there is an air alarm. So people, it's necessary for people to go to the bomb shelter. Yeah. And about 2 days ago, a residential place just 1 kilometer from me was hit by Russians.
You're right. The bombings have become frequent in recent days in Kyiv, as we've seen and heard from our correspondents on the ground. Alexei, thank you for telling us about the situation there. Russia has denied, of course, targeting civilians. Let me come to you, Anna Matveeva, in London. British military intelligence has said Russia's invasion has largely stalled on all fronts, with Russian forces making minimal progress on land, sea or air in recent days. But President Putin has again denied this, saying that the operation is going to plan. Well, what is the reality of the situation as you see it?
Yes. First, I would like to say to Alexei that I have full support and sympathy and solidarity with their plight. And we are, of course, very saddened and shocked with this turn of events. So please accept that as kind of heartfelt words. On Putin, I think it is a quote of Putin has to present a brave front. He cannot come out in the open, address Russian people on the day when there is this huge concert in Moscow showing solidarity and support war effort and say, actually, you know, my strategy has failed. So he has to present the brave front. It's not, it's out of question. But I don't think that we can make any final assessments and say that this is something which is definite. Normally, there would have been several battle plans, several operations. Maybe some of them would be more political with a little bit of military pressure. Some of it was more kind of combination, and some of it would be kind of full-on assault. So Putin has chosen the high-risk strategy, but it does not mean that other strategies do not exist. Putin's normal pattern of behavior is first to test the opponent, politically, militarily, economically, or whatever means, wait for response, evaluate this response, pause, and then take the next step. Now we are seeing that kind of pause and evaluation stage.
Okay.
He is also thinking how things would progress before the next kind of strategy would be activated.
Okay, so Anna, you say we're in the pause and evaluation phase of this Russian strategy. Doug Crane, what are your thoughts? Well, what do you make of this strategy? We've seen a shift towards greater use of artillery and missile strikes against cities such as Kherson, Kharkiv and Mariupol, of course, which has been besieged. What does that say to you about what is to come next in the conflict?
Sure. Thank you. And first, I want to echo Anna's words. Alexei, I wish you nothing but safety right now, and I hope that you're okay. It's incredible that you're joining us as air raid sirens are going around you. So I wish you nothing but safety. As for Russia's strategy, right now, it seems like what Alexei had mentioned before, the attempt to intimidate Ukrainians with massive bombardment and shelling of cities and civilian targets is spot on. I think that we can all recognize by now that Ukrainians are not going to surrender to Russian domination. So even if Russian forces were a bit more effective in their campaigns and were able to seize major cities like Kyiv, I think that we can see now they would not be able to hold them so easily. Mm-hmm. We already see in cities like Kherson where occupiers are being met by demonstrators. Ukrainian operations forces, special operations forces, are also waging significant operations. You know, they recently rescued the captured mayor of Melitopol and freed him. So these attempts to bomb civilian targets, such as the Mariupol theater which was bombed this week, where 1,000 civilians were hiding there. These are attempts to try to cow and the Ukrainian people and physically eradicate any resistance.
Right.
We'll see, though, that that's not going to be so effective.
Alexei, the strength of the Ukrainian resistance has certainly caught many people by surprise, including the Russians. What do you think has worked to their advantage?
Well, look, this is a surprise only for those who do not know Ukraine, who didn't follow results of the poll in Ukraine, who didn't follow events in Ukraine, and who was so-called Putin understanders, believed in, for those who believed in Russian myth about everything which was done by Russia since 2014. Because, you know, Ukrainian patriotism grew in 2014 after first Russian attack of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And let me remind that at that time, Ukraine was totally non-bloc country official, and Russia violated all the agreements. So it increased Ukrainian patriotism, which includes not only Ukrainians, but also ethnic Russians, Crimean Tatars, Jews, and other ethnicity groups which are in Ukraine. So all the polls showed that Ukrainians are going to resist. Ukrainian army was significantly transformed since 2014. But Putin, apparently, he didn't want to believe it. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a system of decision-making in dictatorship state. Nobody is willing to submit him real situation on the ground. So Putin miscalculated. He thought that Ukrainians would be happy to meet Russian soldiers. He misunderstood and miscalculated Ukrainian army, Ukrainian society, and he also miscalculated international support to Ukraine as well.
Right. Interesting that you say that. Anna, you said before that we're in the pause phase of the strategy now, of the Russian strategy. Do you think we are going to see a significant shift of the strategy moving forward? And will the Ukrainians be able to maintain an active defensive military effort, which have been able to do so until now?
Well, the last part of your question is really, I think, has been answered by Alexei. I can tell you that from my perspective, we need to take the peace negotiations, direct talks between Ukrainian and Russian side seriously. We should not dismiss them. We should not be treating them with skepticism or Putin is always a liar. All wars in the end in some kind of peace deal. The sooner it ends in some peace deal, the better for the people of Ukraine. So full support for negotiations. There have been hopeful words from both sides. We do not want to comment too much of them. Let them do their job. Mm-hmm. We need to take it seriously. There probably have to be some compromise from Ukrainian side as well. So
talks are happening, and I mean, the bombardment continues, the siege of Mariupol continues, so it's hard not to be skeptical about whether the talks can achieve anything.
Yeah. Yes, but I covered different wars, and I studied conflicts and wars for almost 30 years of my professional life. We do not have that kind of ideal peace which comes from here. Everybody comes down, sitting down to the negotiation table, takes out their notepads and say, oh, you know, that's kind of, well, you're really making a fair point here. No, real peace comes out of the war. It comes from within the war. And thus, if we look at wars at Yugoslavia, how Croatia and Serbia made peace? Well, through the force of arms. Yeah, mm-hmm. Krajina Serbs have to kind of be displaced, fled, yeah. But in the end, two countries made peace, and this peace is lasting. So we should not be trying to say that this will be some kind of pristine peace deal where everybody is horribly civilized with each other, and right. We are all just sitting and applauding them. It will be a messy process.
Okay,
it's very necessary.
Well, let's take a look at Russia's recent military operations and how they compare to this current one in Ukraine. Russia's entry into Syria's civil war in 2015, for example, helped turn the tide in President Bashar al-Assad's favor. Russian forces relied heavily on intense bombing and indiscriminate air attacks against residential areas. In 1999, Russian forces invaded Chechnya for the second time in 5 years. Then they shifted towards greater use of artillery and missile strikes against major cities. And they also cut off supply lines between cities. The capital of Grozny was leveled in the fighting. 20 years earlier, the then Soviet Union invaded neighboring Afghanistan in an attempt to reinforce a new pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. The Soviets counted on a short-term military operation, but never sent enough soldiers to deal with stiff resistance by Afghans and thousands of foreign fighters. Doug, let me come to you and ask you about, you know, the scale of Russia's military involvement in Ukraine compared to, first of all, the entire capacity of Russian forces and compared to these recent conflicts, whether it's Syria or even going as far back as the Afghanistan war. How has Russia fared? What is different this time around for them?
So this war in Ukraine is perhaps more similar to Soviet involvement in Afghanistan and Russia's wars in Chechnya than compared to involvement in Syria. It's similar to Syria in the fact that they are leveling cities and committing serious atrocities against civilians. But it's different from that because Syria did not have such major ground campaigns from the Russian forces. Afghanistan and Chechnya were long grinding wars against insurgencies eventually that lasted for years and sucked up a major drain from Moscow's forces. This is something that, unfortunately, while it's still very early in Ukraine, this war has only entered its fourth week now. I think that all indications point to that this is something that could stretch on for quite some time. We've already seen that Russia's forces are inadequate for what they're trying to accomplish in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. That's why Syria is sending something like 40,000 Syrian troops to assist them. Russia is trying to bully Belarusian forces into joining them. Russia is asking reportedly China for ammunition, for food, because the food that it sent its soldiers into war with, some of it expired decades ago. So we know that Russian forces were wholly unprepared for what they're finding here. I think that they expected something maybe more similar to what the U.S. experienced in Afghanistan as it withdrew, as the Taliban last year swept rapidly across the country. The government fled and the government collapsed and the Taliban quickly swept into power. That seems like something that the Russians may have expected here. Unfortunately, that's not the reality, and Putin seriously miscalculated.
Anna, your thoughts about this. Do you agree? Is Russia repeating the same mistakes as it did in past operations, whether in Afghanistan or elsewhere?
Yes and no. I think that first thing is it's too early to dismiss a Russian army and Russian firepower. So they are regrouping, they can resupply. So let us kind of not think that they're defeated and they're kind of...
it is early days indeed, yes.
So, yeah, but I have been to Afghanistan, to Grozny, to Aleppo, to Homs, worked in Syria, worked in Chechnya, have seen these places and talked to people who actually lived through the wars. So a bit of kind of hands-on experience there. To some extent, they were all quite different. The war in Chechnya was horrible miscalculation, but remember the Russian army at that time was a conscript army. And they sent into battlefield a lot of completely inexperienced and unwilling conscript. There was also a big opposition within Russia and within Russian military to the campaign. Yeah.
Okay.
So in that situation, they could not really quite send ground troops. So the only available tactic was to bomb Grozny from the air.
Okay.
Syria was different, because Russia started involvement in, for example, in Aleppo only towards the end of 2016, when the war was already raging for 4 years, and there were multiple actors involved in it in all sides.
So all conflicts. So a lot of differences, yeah. You say. Let me come to you, Alexei. The tactic used in Syria was to encircle and besiege rebel-held areas and pound them from the air and from artillery batteries, and in the end, exhaust, really, the defenders and any civilians who had managed to escape. This is not quite what we're seeing yet in Ukraine, but how long, if it is the case, how long will the Ukrainians be able to hold on?
As long as necessary. Again, if we imagine even, you know, worst case scenario, and it's really difficult for me to imagine that Kyiv would surrender, but we will continue fighting, you know, there's no question about that. There is a decisiveness of people. You know, there were recently polls held in Ukraine. 90% are supporting the government. 85% is going to take arms to defend the country. So let me compare these conflicts. I will give you the figures. Okay, in 10 years war in Afghanistan, the Soviet Union lost 15,000 soldiers, 15,000, okay? Now, according to Ukrainian official statistics, Russia lost the same, just in 3 weeks. Okay, maybe Ukrainian statistics is a little bit higher. Americans are talking about 7,000 soldiers, killed Russian soldiers at minimum, okay? So, but you can compare. 15,000 for 10 years in Afghanistan, and let's take 7,000 in 3 weeks. And this 7,000 is more than the U.S. lost in Afghanistan and Iraq for 20 years. So the losses which Russia has are incredible. Russia never had such losses on the ground.
Okay, so these statistics, of course, would be denied by Russia. Let me ask all three of you one last round of questions.
Sorry, everything is denied. Denied by Russia.
Of course.
Russia is not waging the war against Ukraine, and Russia is not targeting civilians.
Okay.
Nazi-type propaganda.
So let me ask you a final round of questions to each one of you. We have very little time left. Let me start with you, Doug. What are the possible scenarios for the outcome of the battle? Will Russia be able to gain full control of Ukraine?
I think there's two options here that could really happen. First, Putin, if he was smart, he would recognize that there is no political victory to be had in Ukraine, that Ukrainians are more motivated to win this war than the Russian soldiers are, and they're more willing to go farther than the Russians. If he was wise and wanted to preserve his rule, he would end this war, he would stop the killing, he would try to, you know, say to the world, you know what, you put these sanctions on Russia and isolated us because of this war, I've ended the war. Lift these sanctions, let's bring companies back to Russia, and he'll try to preserve his rule that way. Unfortunately, I don't think that's what Putin's going to do.
Okay.
Your
thoughts. Sorry, running out of time. I apologize for interrupting you. Anna, your thoughts. What do you see as a possible outcome of this conflict?
For Putin, this is not a war about Ukraine. This is Putin's confrontation with the West. It depends what kind of concessions the West is prepared to give him. And if the West gives him something which will sort of satisfy him, then Ukraine would be spared. If not, we're going to see a very bloody and very destructive and possibly quite long campaign.
Okay, Alexei.
It's a battle with the West.
Alexei, you have the last word. Thank you, Anna. Thank you for that. Alexei, you have the last word. How does this end?
So here, I totally disagree with my Russian counterpart, because it's not the war between Russia and the West. It's not the result of confrontation. Putin has this crazy idea to crush Ukraine. Because without Ukraine, he cannot restore some kind of the Soviet Union or the Russian Empire. So Putin is saying that Ukrainians do not exist as a separate nation, that Ukrainian state is failed. So he would like to crush Ukrainians. We are going to defend. And I think that at the end of the day, Putin will be, it would be necessary for him to withdraw. He cannot win this war. You know, he cannot win it simply.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you for all your thoughts on this very interesting discussion program. Alexei Haran, Anna Matveeva, Doug Klein, thank you for joining us. And thank you for watching. You can always watch this program again anytime by visiting our website at aljazeera.com. For further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can, of course, also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is at AJInsideStory. From me, Fuliba Thibault, and the whole team, thanks for watching. Bye for now.